Okay, well, welcome everyone to this session, IFRS update from the working group. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Michael Dermody. This is the first of a few sessions on 17 at the forum, and we've got four great speakers here for you today. So first of all is Francis Beans. Francis is an actuary with Affinity Consulting and has worked in general insurance for more than 12 years. Francis has consulted general insurers and accident compensation schemes on actuarial evaluations, financial projections, capital and modelling. He's currently a member of the Actuaries Institute AASB 17 Implementation Task Force and the liaison between this task force and the GI Practice Committee of the Institute. The second speaker is David Rush. So David has over 30 years' experience and has extensive and deep involvement in the development, implementation and interpretation of insurance accounting standards, including membership of the AASB Transition Resource Group for AASB in 17 and membership of the Insurance Accounting Implementation Task Force of the Actuaries Institute. David's previously worked at KPMG Actuarial as a director, at APRA where he was a senior executive responsible for matters across life and general insurance, superannuation ADIs, and also at AMP. Over the years, he has also been a member of a number of committees with the Actuaries Institute. Our third speaker is Grant Robinson. Grant is a senior actuary on AMP's IFRS, or Grant was a senior actuary on AMP, Grant is a senior actuary on AMP's IFRS 17 workshop. Moved on. No, I know there was a was here. He used to head up AMP's actuarial systems and process team. He's currently a member of the AASB's Insurance Transition Resource Group and the Actuaries Institute AASB Implementation Task Force. He's been involved in development of the IFRS 17 standard since 2007. We're not actively, you've really confused me because now you've got your non-professional stuff here. We're not actively involved with a new insurance standard through work and participation in the International Actuarial Association. He relaxes by trying to catch fish from his sailing kayak, which given the developments is probably not very often, I would suggest. Our last speaker is Hua Bui. So Hua is stepping in for Brylan. She's a partner at KPMG, is in charge of its actuarial finance and risk practice. She's also vice president of the Institute of Actuaries. She has 30 years of experience in life insurance and superannuation in Australia and Asia Pacific, including being one of three international experts in life insurance advising the Hong Kong government in 2013. She authored the first Australian paper on risk margins for life insurance with Brylan Cummings. Hua is a long-standing member of the International Accounting Standard Committee since 2007 with David and Grant and has been a member of the IFRS Implementation Task Force since inception. So thanks everyone for joining us today, and we're hoping to also, per the plan, leave 10 minutes at the end for questions. And now I'll introduce Francis. Thanks.
Thanks, Michael. I will just clarify, there are three fantastic speakers, David, Grant and Hua, and I'm a general insurance interloper just here for the first few minutes of introduction. Thank you for coming along to our session on AASB 17. Our session includes a very brief overview of the new standard from a life insurance accounting perspective that David and Grant will give, and then we've got a discussion of three key areas of impact or uncertainty that Hua will update us on. The four of us are members of the Institute Task Force, so we're going to start with a very short introduction to the Task Force. Sorry, there's the overview. A very short introduction to the Task Force and interpretation, and then we'll have David and Grant on an overview of the standard with changes for life, and then three areas of uncertainty or impact. And might just give everybody who's wondering in another couple of minutes or seconds. All right, so a brief overview of the task force. Our task force was formed at the end of 2016. The purpose is to assist the Australian actuarial profession to prepare for AASB 17. A key milestone of the task force was the release of a detailed information note, which has been available in draft form to members since March. The task force has broad representation. We've got about 60 active participants across the three practice areas that AASB 17 will apply to, so life, health and general insurance. But today's session is focused only on life insurance. We're not going to review the standard or the information note in a lot of detail because we've only got 40 minutes. Instead, it'll be a very focused discussion on the key changes and impacts for life insurers. Before we get to that, though, I just wanted to touch on how AASB 17 gets interpreted. So there's a bit of a process that's been set up to assist with interpretation of the standard. The International Accounting Standards Board, or the IASB, has set up a Transition Resource Group, or a TRG, comprised of individuals from around the world who've got insurance accounting experience. The purpose of the TRG is to provide a forum for discussion of significant implementation questions and inform the IASB so that it can decide if anything needs to be done in response to the questions. Things that might be done, for example, could be case studies or webinars, so additional materials that they could produce, or referring specific questions to IFRIC, which is the International Financial Reporting Interpretations Committee. In parallel, the Australian Accounting Standards Board has also set up an Australian TRG. There's around 30 participants in the Australian TRG, with broad representation across insurers, advisors and government. The Australian TRG's purpose is to debate the papers presented to the international TRG and tease out the Australian specific issues, make sure that things that are relevant to Australia will be heard at the international level. Anne Driver from QBE and also a member of our Actuaries Institute Task Force is on both the Australian and the IASB TRGs, so we've got a direct link to that international level. The TRG has had a couple of meetings already in 2018, and David Grattan-Hua's presentations incorporate relevant outcomes from those discussions. There are additional meetings this year and then additional meetings next year in 2019. The TRG is hoping to finish its job by the end of 2019 so that everything's crystal clear by then and it's a smooth transition to 2021. And one last thing, while we're talking about interpretation, given this is an accounting standard, what's the role for actuaries? So ultimately, interpretation of the standard is going to be an accounting question. And so the accountants are going to do that. Having said that, actuaries will obviously have a key role in assisting companies to understand the operation, to debate the interpretations, and a significant role in applying the standard. With many of the calculations that are going to be done, they'll be done by the actuarial community. There'll have to be a close relationship, working relationship between accountants and actuaries. So I'm now going to pass over to David to get into the really exciting stuff.
Yeah, really exciting isn't necessarily the word I would have used for this. But anyway, okay. All right, I'm going to cover two basic changes, really big changes that people are going to experience with when they introduce IFRS 17. The first of these is a risk adjustment, an explicit risk adjustment, and the second is the use of what's been called the premium allocation approach for short-term business, which some people might use kind of like it at the moment, but it'll be quite different going forward. So the first of these is the risk adjustment. Now, Australian GIs, general insurers, have had to allow for this for many years, and now it is being explicitly applied to life insurers as well. Now, a couple of things to note. The definition for risk adjustment is up there. A couple of things particularly you should note. One is that it is determined from the entity's perspective. It's not imposed from on high by the regulator or whatever the standard might be, or the standard itself. It's determined by the entity itself. Note also that it is in relation to non-financial risk. So issues in relation to financial risk are allowed for elsewhere. Now, previously, the risk adjustment was kind of there, we just didn't notice it. It was kind of absorbed implicitly in the profit margin under margin on services. Now it is explicit rather than implicit, thus reducing what is left, the remainder of profit, which is what's now known as the contractual service margin, or CSM. So the loss recognition threshold is now higher. The loss recognition threshold used to be when the profit margin went negative. Now it's when the CSM goes negative. And because the CSM is smaller, the loss recognition threshold when the CSM goes negative is potentially higher and has been raised. Now, and also finally, as profit currently includes the expected release of the profit the risk adjustment implicit in the profit margin, so profit in the future will explicitly include release of the risk adjustment. Grant will talk a little bit more about that. Now, so how do you determine the risk adjustment? Well, currently, life insurers have to do risk margins, have to set risk margins required for regulatory capital. So it makes sense to use what's previously been done, to leverage that that's already been done. However, the risk margins that are stipulated by the regulator must be sufficient to meet a 1 in 250 eventuality. Whereas, as I said before, the risk adjustment is determined by the entity itself at a level consistent with the entity's own risk appetite. Well, admittedly, that's also required by APRA. So, whereas the risk margin is 1 in 250, it's specified, the risk adjustment could be at various levels. But the idea would be to leverage that work that's previously been done already and adjust it accordingly. Apart from that, there are several different ways to determine what the risk adjustment should be. So you could leverage the capital risk margin work, you could use the cost of capital method, you could use a confidence interval approach. But as I said, they need to be consistent with the entity's risk appetite. Now, the risk adjustment can allow for diversification within a group that the entity belongs to, is part of. Now, how much of the diversification should be allowed for? Well, that's kind of not specified. But the ISB staff in a recent TRG meeting expressed the view that the risk adjustment should be the same for both the group and for the individual entity. In other words, the entity from that perspective is the entity that is party to the contract, not necessarily the group as a whole. So the two should be the same. Now, having determined the risk adjustment for each group, it then needs to be subdivided between all of the various components of the liability within that group that require a risk adjustment, namely the liability for future, the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for incurred claims. Finally, we should note that however the risk adjustment is determined, whether you leverage the capital margin work, whether you use the cost of capital approach, confidence interval approach, however you determine the risk adjustment, it needs to be disclosed what the equivalent confidence interval is for that risk adjustment corresponding to that risk adjustment. So that needs to be disclosed. So some have said that because you have to disclose the confidence interval, you might as well use the confidence interval approach. Oh, gone dark. There. So the unearned premium approach that's mentioned there will be familiar to general insurers, and as I said, it's also been used for some individual risk business and for some group business already. Essentially, to be eligible to use the premium allocation approach, the PAA, the liability so determined must not materially differ from the liability measured under the general model. Now, for the liability not to differ materially, there must not be significant variability in cash flows and the risk adjustment. Note particularly that this test is done at inception, when the contract is incepted. So if the contract boundary is 12 months or less, then the eligibility test does not have to be applied. It is assumed that the liability in those cases will not differ materially from the liability measured under the general approach. And so PAA can automatically be used in those circumstances. But if the contract boundary is greater than 12 months, then you need to do the test. Finally, you should note that just because the contract boundary is 12 months or less does not mean that the PAA must be used. You can use it, but you don't have to use it if you don't want to. Sorry? Okay. And that diagram just kind of puts in pictures what I've just said. So finally, if the entity takes the view that the YRT is a series of one-year contracts, i.e. it's less than 12, the contract boundary is 12 months or less, after considering all the guidance that that is available, then you can use the PAA for that business. Note that the business which uses the PAA, then the test for onerousness, if the contract is onerous, is if facts or circumstances indicate that the contract is onerous. So it's not objective like under the general model, if the CSM is negative. It's more a more general test in terms of facts and circumstances. Note also that that various changes that result from the YRT are being short-term. So it will change the profit pattern. So instead of basically spreading the profit, you'll make a very big loss in the first year and profits subsequently. It'll change the risk adjustment, so you only need to hold the risk adjustment for 1 year rather than for all future years. And it'll change grouping, as previously noted. Finally, use of the PAA might not necessarily just apply to YRT business. It might also affect other business, which is mentioned there, group contracts, some reinsurance business, and also step premium disability income business. This is particularly relevant for some group business. Now, although they might not necessarily have a contract boundary which is less than 12 months, so you may actually have to do an explicit test for that business, because in many cases the repricing period is longer than 12 months, i.e. 3 years. Group PAR business may not be eligible to use the PAA because the PAA does not include a bonus reserve, which has to be included for PAA business for PAR business. So the question then is, how flexible is the PAA? And this might also be a relevant question for friendly society business or some investment business where people want to use the PAA. Well, you may not be able to. Otherwise, valuation under the PAA should be similar to what is done currently. Finally, you should note that the profitability of new business or new contracts that are written under an existing contract will need to be taken into account. So that'll need to be taken into account in determining facts and circumstances. And also, as the risk adjustment is now explicit rather than implicit, as I said before, it'll raise the loss recognition threshold. So previously, where a business might have been line ball, it'll probably almost certainly be in loss recognition now. Okay, that's enough for me, probably more than enough for me. So I'll hand over to Grant.
Thank you, David. Right. This is probably one of the fun topics that's been debated vigorously in a large number of forums in Australia, and I don't have a definitive answer because I don't have all your facts and circumstances, which is fortunate for me. But basically, individual contract is fairly easy. You reassess the risks and you can fully reprice, and you can do that when it comes up for underwriting each time in theory, though reality in GI varies. For portfolio, it comes, can you kind of do the equivalent thing at a portfolio level? Do you have the practical ability to do it? Can you reassess the risks at a portfolio level? And can you fully reflect on the repricing? That's primarily the key things. And the other little catch is, does the premium pricing for coverage to the repricing point does not reflect risk beyond that point? Now, these have been this whole area has had a number of discussions in the Australian forums at the Actuaries and Auditors Liaison Committee, the AASB TRG. There's been four papers at the last two RGs around this topic, both insurance and reinsurance around that. And if you really want to understand, you're going to have to unfortunately go through that by the time you need to write it up for your auditors. But the quick high level of what the issues are is basically, what are the risks in that assessment? And the staff and the TRG were fairly clear. It's basically risk transferred from the policyholder. It's not the company's risks around expenses and lapses. It's really around financial and insurance risks. And fully repriced means basically, if you have a general right to reprice in line with markets going up and down, that doesn't cut it. You've got to be able to fully reprice means it reflects the general experience of the book in some sense. Practical ability means effectively that you can do it. And commercial constraints are not an issue there, which is really good news, so long as they also apply to new business. In other words, the broad test is, if you are taking that portfolio on, can you set a price for that the same as you would if it was a whole new business portfolio with a mix of underlying experience sitting inside it? If you can do that, then the commercial constraints don't matter. So the fact that you're currently not pricing your IP up to its full level on your new business means you don't have to fully price your new up on the other as well. So that gets you out of jail. And the real fun piece, which I know has concerned a number of people, is how do you handle continuation options? Basically, the answer is, unless you can reprice the portfolio and every contract arising from the continuation options together as a whole, then all everything arising from the continuation options is inside the sole assessment as well, which is a really nasty little rider if you're not careful. And the real fun piece, this isn't accounting choice. It's really application of judgment, careful assessment of facts and circumstances. And given this, is probably the most material item of judgment and the most material item when it comes to doing an IFRS balance sheet on conversion from life companies, probably they're going to get the most scrutiny from the auditors, etc. So that's going to be the real fun topic and to discuss. I mean, it really just does directly change your business. Your DAC disappears, the ROE goes up to the roof because you recycle a large chunk of it, assuming that your commission levels are coming down, which I think is generally happening in the industry. So this is a short cheat sheet to the kind of how you think through it. And this is basically a user-friendly, simplified diagram that works on a PowerPoint, which is really pinched for one that Brett Pickett put together for the Institute's note, except I've rearranged it slightly. He said, basically, the first question is, does the premium cover risks beyond the repricing? In other words, are you basically pre-funding from past premiums for risks in the future to a significant extent? That means if you've got level premium business, it effectively drops straight out. The answer is yes, it does, and it's a long-term contract. If the answer is no, then you have to go to the next question, which is really, do you actually have a right to reprice? I think in most cases in Australia you do, so that's probably an easy one. The answer is yes, you go to the next one, which is, can you actually reflect the portfolio experience? I suspect that's the case for most people's repricing rights in Australia, but I've only ever looked at a few of our own contracts, so I can't really comment on that one. And then basically the constraints one is, effectively, when you're doing that repricing exercise, if you've got any constraints about your ability to reprice your portfolio, it would apply differently to what business. And I think, again, that's generally not an issue in Australia either, but again, it's facts and circumstance. And if you get through all of those, the good news from my perspective is that your repricing point is your boundary. The reason that's the good news is because PA is an awful lot simpler to do and implement than the full general model, and it's much easier for implementation. And the other really good news is It does magic things to your ROE on your business. It makes your capital a lot lower as well. And so this, the next session is kind of basically to think about, there's been a lot of discussions in this whole thing around CSM and what is happening to profits in CSM, and everybody's tended to focus on CSM. But the other important part is what's also happening on the risk adjustment. That's your other major source of profit. And so those are your two key drivers. Your CSM is really basically based on insurance coverage, quantity benefits, expected duration, unless, and this is the first proposed amendment to IFRS 17 from the ISB staff, that they're going to extend, make an amendment to make it clear that you can actually also recognise the investment service for VFA business, which is good news. There's another argument as to whether you can get that wider. My bet is probably unlikely, but people will try. And then you basically update. And that's going to be a major source of profit for PAR business, and you, those who've got nice profitable risk business. For those who haven't got profitable annuity business or haven't got very profitable IP business, CSM is not going to be a major issue for assessing what your profit looks like. And then you've got your risk adjustment. And that's released from non-financial use for future services. And this is probably the really fun difference from GI. It's the GI risk adjustment is really primarily around your claims risk, incurred claims risk. In our space, you've got a large amount of complexity about assessing this for your future service, especially on long-term contracts. And it's a source of profit when the group is onerous because you've still got a risk adjustment sitting there, and it slowly releases as the risk runs off. And the insurance company, and that will be a major source of profit for annuities. In fact, I suspect it will absorb pretty well all the profit margins if you've got any on your annuity book and more besides. And for income protection as well, depending on how profitable it is. And I've actually got a few slides to hopefully try and illustrate what this might look like. I don't promise they're absolutely accurate. This is the one that's based off one that we actually did for the ISB TRG and actually picked up on it. The purple line shows you what happens if you use sum at risk. That's your sum at risk on the left-hand side. The gold line going down from the right is actually what hit the runoff of your sum at risk and your bonuses and your terminal bonuses. In other words, what you repay out on death. And your red line is your current MOS profit margin release. And everybody tends to not notice because it's all blended books, but effectively you actually get a very large kick-up in profit getting close to the actual end of the contract from your terminal bonus component under MOS. And then effectively what you're likely to see under IFRS 17 is effectively the pink stuff is effectively CSM, which is pretty well most of it. The green there is your risk adjustment piece, but broadly, and that's probably overstated, but if I actually made it to scale, you probably wouldn't be able to see it for PAR book. And it just basically runs off. So it's much smoother pattern than you're currently getting. Annuities, this simple example assumes that you've got a 5% profit margin for annuity book overall on a MOS type basis, and the risk adjustment, my bet, is will absorb about 3%, so it'll leave you another 2% for your CSM. And as you can see, this is actually a 10-year guaranteed annuity, so there's no release from the CSM. Whoops, I don't know what happened there. Did I get to the wrong? Right. Technology is wonderful. Any questions while we're waiting for the technology? Yep. Sorry, I'm not. So, which question? Premium experience. I don't think there's been a discussion in the TRG around whether how premium experience is reflected in CSM.
I think earlier there was discussion
about whether it's included in the current period premium experience or future period. I think that's an interpretation question. I don't think there's been nothing in the TRG on that topic that I'm aware of. So I think it's open. And so basically you get some release from your risk adjustment in the early years, but not a lot, because effectively you don't really start running off your risk of payments until you start making your life contingent payments as opposed to term certain. And your CSM under this interpretation just runs off. There is a bit of uncertainty at the moment, depending on what plays out in this whole question around extending the VFA exemption more widely, that may change the picture for the annuities. But on my personal betting is it's probably not likely to get that wide. And also I understand at least one major player in the annuity market is still open. Their book is actually loss-making, so it's not a big issue, CSM. Okay. So IP is a bit more fun. Again, you've got this valid claim. So effectively for IP, what it actually means is you basically got... Your coverage is actually effectively unit is basically all the future payments if somebody goes on claim now. So if you go to age 65 benefit, that means all the way to age 65. And your risk adjustment has got a major driver from your claims, open claims, as well as your future service. And so you've got to find a very interesting pattern coming out of that. And that just shows you here, the green bars show you your future service. So at age 20, which is the right-hand side, you've got a huge amount of service being recognised in the coverage unit from age 20 if you went on claim. And that really does interesting things to your coverage unit release for CSM, which basically says why you got the blue. For short-term IP, coverage unit makes no difference whether you allow for recoveries or not. But for long-term, if you don't allow for recoveries, which is almost certainly the outcome from the ISB discussions, you're going to heavily upfront your IP profit release until you actually allow for lapses, in which case it doesn't look quite so bad when you put a portfolio together of lapses. And given our bad lapse experience, that's probably helpful. But and then this one here, which is fun to put together, basically shows you what happens with your risk adjustment. So you get a profit release upfront on your CSM, and your risk adjustment actually consumes profit in the first few years. And that's really about, and I'm not sure that's quite right, but the broad picture is right, because effectively what's happening is most of your risk adjustment is sitting on your open claims book, because once you've got open claims, even if the cover stops, they stop paying future premiums, you're still on the hook. And so you you get this build-up of open claims if you've sold a group, and that means your risk adjustment's going up and then starts releasing in the later years. And now I hand over to Wah for the areas of uncertainty. I wish there are plenty, but these are just a few good snippets.
Yeah. Thank you, Grant. I'm an optimistic person, so I've only picked three areas of uncertainty. Those of you who have been following this development know that there are lots more of uncertainty than this, but I'm realistic, and I know that we've only got 5 minutes to talk about it. I'm keen to hear your questions. So in the committee, we debated which one we should pick, and so we ended up with these three. Now, I picked these three because I don't think that there is an interpretation uncertainty, but there is a lot of uncertainty about how it would impact the companies, and you'll find out when I show you the list. And secondly, also about how you manage the product and the profit emergence. So this is by no means an exhaustive list. If you would like a more exhaustive list, you should refer to the workshop slide that the task force produced. So I think of the ones that we are aware of, these are the three that would impact Australia, and they are quite big operational impact. The first one is very obscure, and I don't believe was actually intended, well, from a development perspective, but it actually is now in the standard, and we don't know whether it will be changed or not. But basically, at the moment, you're allowing for premium receivable in general insurance and in life insurance. But in the new world, the standard wants us to account for premium received, which is very different to premium due. And that's a big, big change, is our accounting systems are not set up for it. We don't think like that, and we don't project like that. So it's a very big change. It's not an interpretation uncertainty at all. And there is one area where there is global agreement between accountants, actuaries and the auditors that the standard should change. The second one is, of course, reinsurance. Now, some of you may already hear and talk about this. But basically, at the moment, we are required to disclose and consider the gross contract and the reinsurance contract separately. But in practice, they are considered together. So, for example, if you have a contract that makes $30 profit every year and you reinsure it 50% on original terms, you expect to get $15 in the net result and you expect $15 to be deducted. But in the new world, a combination of provisions, when taken together, means that you can have very unexpected and non-intuitive emergence of profit. So, for example, if your YIT underlying contract is short-term, is classified as short-term, but your reinsurance contract is classified as long-term, you'll have a situation where you might make $100 of loss in the first year for the gross contract, and you might expect a profit of 30, say, for every year after. Now, if you reinsured at 50% quota share, you would expect 50 and 15, right? But that's not how it's going to happen, because you have to spread your profit on your contract for insurance. So you will make $12.50 of profit in your reinsurance, but you still have to take the $100 in the first year for your underlying contract. And therefore, your profit release will look like 82.5 of losses in the first year, rather than 50, so you get less relief due to your reinsurance, and then you get a kick up of profit later on. So it defer your profit, if you like. There are other unpleasant and complex consequences of this as well. So when you change assumption, you may not get to spread it anywhere. You may have to take it. A reinsurance contract cannot be onerous. It was actually specified as one single sentence, and that's also meant that if you have a contract which is onerous at the start, you have nowhere to go, you have to take it, etc., etc. So this is not, I guess there's no uncertainty about interpretation, but it is uncertainty about how you manage the book going forward and how you design your reinsurance contract and the effectiveness of the reinsurance to actually offset or help you with your profit emergence. And the third one is unbundling. I guess this one affects mostly Australian companies, but in 2005, insurers in Australia unbundled our investment product from our insurance riders. But now you can only do that if they can lapse independently. And in most cases, if you write it under a master trust, for example, they can't lapse independently. So unless you change your contract before the start of this standard, you will have to rebundle them. And that's also, operationally, companies have now got used to valuing investment contract, you know, with account balance, and now you're not going to be able to do that and still comply with the standard. So those are the three areas of uncertainty or operational impact that we've picked. I'm sure that there are many others that the audience would be aware of as well, and we're happy to take questions.
Anyone? Any questions first? Yeah. Yeah, at the microphone, sorry.
Please, yeah. Please direct it to the whole committee.
Yes.
Just on the, we ended up with a, I think, potential short contract boundary, and I think the speaker said that was good because it ends up with an easier PAA approach. If someone was using the, I'll call it the building block approach because I can't remember what it's called now, that for the a short contract boundary, would you expect a different answer? Or just more complicated operational?
My sense of it is that it would be materially the same.
apart from the fact you'd be holding possibly, you have a choice about whether you do acquisition cost or not under the PAA, defer it for the 6 months to the boundary. But I think you just have an awful lot more work and an awful lot more disclosure, and that's the big thing. Just the PAA, and it's easy to explain.
Microphone. My question is about reinsurance and contract boundaries, because the latest TRG discussion, I think you end up potentially with an open-ended reinsurance contract boundary, because you're going to continuously have new contracts under a proportional reinsurance, just a continual addition of new contracts over time. And then my other question is the issue of cash flows in reinsurance contracts. Are you supposed to count all the cash flows, even of contracts, underlying contracts that you haven't written yet, for an undefined contract boundary period?
Reinsurance is quite broken, yes, I agree.
Yeah, I think it's quite broken. The good news is there's probably lots of opportunities if it doesn't get fixed. Depending on your contract, I mean, a lot of contracts you'll find actually are. I mean, I haven't looked through proportional, but certainly quota share ones. Usually, both parties have a right to turn off the light in the new business. So they are closed in that sense, but it's not very closed. That cuts your boundary. And then after that, it's really, all your future new business is inside your reinsurance treaty. So in quota shares, all the increases on my in-force, which you naturally want to be inside a quota share because otherwise life gets far too messy, they are now in your projection as well. But then the contract boundary just does nasty things to you.
In terms of your question about whether the reinsurance contract boundary is basically open-ended, my understanding is that most reinsurance contracts include some element of repricing, i.e. the reinsurer or the the cedent has some ability in the case of the cedent, they have a right to exit. In the case of the reinsurer, they have a right after a while to reprice the contract, and so that would affect the contract boundary.
Yeah, but you really have to go through the details, and I didn't actually bother covering the reinsurance side of that thing on contract boundary, because you have to turn your head on your thing. So your rights are basically your right to receive the benefits on the reinsurer, the coverage, and your obligations are the obligation to pay premiums, and the driver of the assessment is what goes with that. So the repricing rights that the reinsurers have, that doesn't change your contract boundary, and any recapture rights don't change your contract boundary, which is what the recent TRG paper concluded, because effectively that's not something that you as an insurer have any control over. And on the other hand, if you have a right to terminate the contract, that automatically changes things in some way. So, but if he has a repricing rights kind of boundary, then you've got the premium rights. So it's really a bit messy. I've tried to work it through for our own firm on quota share, and I'm still trying to also figure out how to model the thing as a whole.
So I thought the right to stop, the contract is basically the same as the right to lapse. So you actually just do that as a probabilistic overlay on your cash flows. There was another question which I've now forgotten.
I'd highlight their conclusion about the compulsion to pay premiums. And the fact that the contract boundary provision is an or. So if you've got compulsion to pay premiums or you've got the repricing aspects or the detail, then, if you're compelled to pay premiums indefinitely, then you've got an indefinite contract boundary, it seems to me. Now, a question about whether you're compelled is quite the thing.
Yeah, that's right. You have to look at the two together. I think in most cases you've got a right to turn off the new business. But, it's a real mess.
Maybe last question on reinsurance.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, is it possible we should just jump, given time, is there any other questions on other burning topics? Because this one can go on for an awful long time.
Yeah, does anyone have any other questions? Maybe Grant, people might be interested in what the committee's doing next and just how big this reform is likely to be.
Well, I think we're at the moment we're busy updating the wider.
Yep. Yeah. Just.
Do you want to speak to that?
Our task force, I think, is basically working on updating the IN for the feedback and the latest TRG, and then we'll basically try to keep updating. That's quite a large task, so we may begin to flag after a while, I suspect, but we'll see how we go.
Given that the TRG is meeting every quarter, basically. So we would be looking for, and this might be ambitious, but we'd be looking to update the IN information note every quarter. Now, as I said, that might be ambitious, but that's kind of the timing.
One final question. I understand the International Actuarial Association is getting together the International Actuarial Notes on this. Do we know the time frame on that?
My understanding from having to the ISAP 4 webinar was there was a discussion and that wasn't totally clear. They were indicating in that they were aiming for probably the quarter three. However, being in a couple of conversations on a couple of the key missing pieces, I think that's ambitious. They're aiming to release it as a whole. Given that, I think they're going to struggle to get it out this year myself, in my personal bet.
I think it's fair to say that the Australian Task Force actually has the best progress of all the notes, information notes that I'm aware of. Yeah.
Okay. Any last questions? Okay. I mean, one very last one from me. Obviously, there's a lot of uncertainty with the contract boundary. Seems to be some people talking about, are we going to all get crunched in terms of resourcing next year when we finally get going with it, whether the task force had any thoughts on that and where companies are up to?
I don't think we've had a conversation as to where companies are up to. Aware various companies are in different places on the journey and different priorities.
From my perspective, I think there is a lot to be gained by companies actually trying to understand whether the contracts that you're having in place now would still achieve the same outcome that you expected to. So if I was, looking at reinsurance, I would be looking at what reinsurance offset would I get in the new world and whether I need to change the contract to achieve what I need to get. Similarly, for my top policy terms and conditions. That's what I'd be doing now, because a lot of it is already there and it's not going to be changed. We're not going to expect wholesale changes, but your reaction to it is certainly something that you can start planning now, and it could make a big difference to your profit emergence in the future and your ability to manage your portfolio.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, everyone. Thanks for your participation. And would you please join me? Oh, sorry, one reminder I meant to say is to please fill in your feedback forms on your tablet or phone. But would you please join me in thanking Hua, Grant, David and Francis.